accession number 23377, Reel 3.
This is the second reel of a taped interview with Peter Gray in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 1st of the 4th, 2002, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Peter, could we continue by you telling us, you talked a little bit about your joining up, or your call-up. Can we talk about what was involved in you joining the Navy proper, and the training that was involved as well?
You mean after I was...
Called up.
The first part of the training, of course, was down in Fremantle. We were inducted and went through the initial bits of inoculation and vaccination and all those sorts of things that occur. And we were also taught how to march, etc., and some of those long, weary marches from Fremantle down to South Beach and back before morning tea of a morning, and that sort of thing. Plus, we were put into ship boats such as whalers and cutters and that sort of thing, and had to do the journey by boat on those big, long, cumbersome oars that seemed to take charge of you. Were a bit hard to handle for a start, but with a bit of practice that all came into being, and that lasted for a period of a couple of months before they we were all then sent to Flinders Naval Depot, where the main part of your training was started. And there, of course, that was for a start, the weather turning from light autumn weather in WA to cold autumn and winter weather in Melbourne was pretty severe. But you're not allowed to sit around idle for a moment. Every waking moment that there was occupied in training of some sort, and for light relief, of course, there was you were pitched into all sorts of athletic games you'd never ever touched or tried before. And as most of us were Australian rules fiends, and you got chucked into playing rugby and soccer and lacrosse and all sorts of unusual games as far as we were concerned, but the training was quite solid, and of course all the training in seamanship, gunnery, torpedoes, and all that sort of thing, that was all very intense. Once a fortnight you were allowed to what was known as going up the line. You were given weekend leave and went up to Melbourne and come back again. That was via the train from Crib Point up to Melbourne. And you were packed in like sardines. The train used to pull into the depot, and God knows how many thousands of sailors scrambled aboard this thing and were off to Melbourne. But all very orderly and all very well controlled, and very much in the all in order as far as that was concerned. But the training itself was very interesting, with all the concentration that needed to be on gunnery, torpedoes, and all the armaments, and the general seamanship, so that you knew what was coming up, and or roughly what was coming up. And
how much of that training time was spent on board ships?
None. That was all land-based. That was all... you were still doing a little bit of work on pulling boats or a bit of sailing and that sort of thing. But that was about the only time you were on the water, apart from the times when you were taken down to give swimming tests and you had to jump into the water fully clothed and swim 50 yards with all your gear on. Little did we know then that although we regarded it as a bit of a futile exercise, that in the long run it was something that we had done, and at least you'd touch the edges of it.
How frustrating was it for you to be sailors but to not actually be on a ship yet?
I think that's something that everybody goes through in lots of phases of your life. You're a rookie, or you're one of those who might come, and those who are more experienced will sneer at you, jibe at you, and all that sort of thing. But once you've been through it, then of course you're in a position later on to return the compliment to some other poor coot. But it's something just you don't worry about too much.
Were there particular ships that people talked about and hoped that they might be a part of the crew on?
Oh yes, some people who were more inclined to go for the bigger ships. Most people look to go for the smaller ships. When I say smaller ships, destroyers and that type of ship. There was perhaps more latitude in discipline and reliance on your own initiatives in those sorts of ships than what there was in some of the larger ships, where because of a greater number, discipline was more paramount. But I was never taken to any of the very small ships, such as the minesweepers and those sorts of ships. To me, they were just a bit too small to be sailing across some of these oceans that around the place. But most people were quite determined and quite interested in being in a fighting ship more than anything.
Was there a sort of concern that these fighting ships obviously would be in the heat of, ultimately in the heat of battle?
Oh yes, yeah, that was part of the deal sort of thing, that if you're going to be involved, then you were involved in it right up to your back teeth. There was no hanging back with it. Of course, being young and brash and full of your own importance, your own confidence, etc., that was part of the deal. You were better than the other bloke, and your ship was better than the other ship. And that was roughly the attitude of most people in the Navy.
Did you allow yourself the thoughts of what might happen if you'd been in a ship that was sunk?
Never, no. That was perhaps some of the supreme confidence that you had, that your ship was never going to get sunk anyway. Irrespective of what happened, that was the confidence that you had in your ship, in your officers, in your shipmates, everybody. You just had that absolute confidence. And this was something that I guess came naturally as much as anything after you'd been with these people, because you developed that confidence one with the other.
Where do you think this confidence would come from?
Just natural, I guess. That's if you're with people, you have your own self-reliance, and that would spread to a certain extent from one to the other, simply because the operations that you undertook were successful, and because it was successful, that reliance of your own spread to reliance on other people, and I think that was the way that it worked there, or that was the way that I saw it anyway.
So when was it that you were to learn that you'd be on the Perth?
It wasn't until August 1941. As you come to the end of your period of training, then the word gets out that they're starting to send everybody to various ships and establishments and so forth, some for more training and that sort of thing. At the end of the our training period, we were some of the first to go, and we were sent up to Sydney. As I remember it, there was somewhere about 20 of us, I think, were going up to the Perth. We were told that we were going to the Perth, of course we were aware that she had been over in the Mediterranean, had been in the Battle of Matapan and in the Cretan landings operations that were taking place over in the Mediterranean, and she had a fine record in the Mediterranean, and again that was a point that you've got a good ship, she's proven herself and the crew has proven to be right, so when you go on board you have that confidence again. But
she had been damaged in one of the incidents in the Mediterranean.
That's right, in the port of Alexandria. She'd been hit by a 1,000-pound bomb, and there were quite a few casualties, and she had been damaged, and when she came back, as I spoke about there, we had to stand in shivering cold on man-o-war steps waiting for the captain to give his final address to the crew before leaving the ship, which is a very fine thing to do, and it's a mark of respect to his crew for the captain to do this sort of thing. When they came off, we were allowed on, etc., and of course we were at the same time, there were a lot of the members of the crew were disembarking to go on leave. They were to have leave while the ship was being refitted, or they had given a period of leave. So we inherited a relatively empty ship. We were only a few of the crew, of course. There was the nominal crew was 681 or 678, so we were only a relatively few of the crew, but of course there was quite a lot of hard work to be done, such as for the ship to go into dry dock, which it had to, you've got to de-ammunition the ship, which means that every lousy round of ammunition has got to be taken up by a hoist up to the top, onto the top deck, and then it is put on a hoist and loaded down into a lighter, then it's got to be taken away to the ammunition store. But the Perth, of course, was a 6-inch cruiser, and the she had the 6-inch shells, and they weigh 112 pound each, and every time you bend down to pick up one of these blasted shells, it gets a bit tiring at the end of a day, and it's day after day to do this thing. But of course, we eventually got it done, and the way it all went, and then the ship was towed down to Cockatoo Dock and into the dry dock.
What was your first impression of the ship when you saw it?
Beautiful. Very fine ship. It looked the part, and it sort of fulfilled your ambitions, if you like, that I'm going to be part of that crew, that ship, and she just looked the part.
To what degree is a young man heading off, he's finally on a ship, or he's about to be on a ship, the fact that the Perth had been involved in action and had even been damaged, did that sort of detract at all from the sense that the ship was, I don't know, jinxed or something?
No. It had proven itself, and it wasn't a damaged goods, if you like. It was it was something that had honourable scars, if you like to use that sort of simile on it. It was that was the way you thought of it, and of course, as I say, you're young and you're full of confidence, and you want to be there and get into it.
You're mentioning the captain giving the speech. Was this Hector Waller?
No, this was Captain Bayer Smythe. He was an RN skipper. In those days, particularly in the early part of the war, it was quite common to have RN officers. That's Royal Naval officers. As a matter of fact, we had, I suppose, 4 or 5 RN officers, apart from where Bayer Smythe had been on board. But I didn't have anything to do with him. I didn't know him because he went off the ship and went away to do all his stuff that he had to do, such as report to headquarters and all that sort of thing. But we were only interested, of course, in getting the ship back into gear and getting on with the business.
What were your quarters like?
Pretty rough and ready for a start, because once we moved down into the dry dock, the ship became full of dockyard mateys. All these blokes that came down to do work on the ship. There was a lot to be done. A lot of the ducting work throughout the ship had been damaged, electrical work had been damaged, plumbing and steam and all the rest of it. Because when a 1,000-pound bomb drops down through the deck and goes off bang, it makes a hell of a mess. So there's a lot of different trades had to come in to mend the ship, put it back into gear. So you were pushed from pillar to post, as it were, because all the other members of the crew, all the permanent, or the ones who had been on board before, they all had their own spots. The new blokes had to fit in where they could. Of course, that was what we were doing, just fitting in. But of course, on board ship, you are a lot of a mess, and an area in which you live, you have a locker, and you have a hammock. And there were always tending to be problems with where you slung your hammock, and because you worked on different watches when you were at sea, you worked on these different times, so you slept at different times to different people. But eventually I got my own spot and had it all set out, and that was sacrosanct as far as I was concerned. I was prepared to push anybody aside that tried to take over.
What would be your initial watch?
Oh, the initial watch, well, you had various watches in that you had when you were sailing, I just can't think of the word at the moment, but when you were just in ordinary sailing mode, there were no problems, any trouble, you were four on and eight off, and of course that varied every day because that's the way the watch system works. You also you could be in three watches, you could be in four watches, or you could be in two watches, depending on the severity or the danger that you were in. Three watches, there was no problems. Four watches, that meant that you were, you had, perhaps I better explain it. You had red, white and blue watches, and you also had port and starboard watches. Now, you were members of one of those two groups all the time, and in four watches, you were in port and starboard watch, but you were also on the first part or the second part. You could be in four watches, but that was three, four, or when you were in two watches, then you were... you were closing up to some sort of danger, etc. And then, of course, you had action stations, which was everybody was closed up the whole time, and the ship was an absolute fighting unit at that time. So your watches varied from day to day, and but you still had duties. You had a part of ship. The ship was divided into four parts, forecastle, main top, foretop and quarterdeck. And you belong to a part of ship. You could be a forecastle man, and you could be in the red watch, and you could be in the port watch as well. So you had to know where you were the whole time. But it worked very efficiently, and everybody knew their position, where they were, etc. But the part of ship, that was the part that you had to keep efficient, keep it clean and all the rest of it. Of course, the first duty of the day was to get out of bed. Now, this was when you were at sea, was to, once you were out, of course, you went straight to action stations before dawn. And then when you came back from clearing action stations, and of course you went to breakfast, and then you get out and you clean ship, whatever. You might be scrubbing the deck, you might be sweeping a place down below, or whatever you had to do. But during wartime, you only worked up until lunchtime, and in the afternoon you had what they called a make and mend. So that was your own time. Because of the number of watches that you had to keep during the wartime, so that people were fresh, you only worked the morning watch, that was the forenoon watch, and then the afternoon, there was a make and mend. But it was, I suppose to some degree, a fairly relaxed sort of atmosphere, but the moment you thought it was relaxed, then suddenly you'd get a An order comes through that you're going to practice something like putting out paravanes or doing all sorts of funny things. And you had to know exactly where you were, what you had to do, and so that it was an efficient operation no matter what you were doing.
What did you practice most often?
Work, I guess. But
in a wartime situation, in a combat situation, what would your duties have been?
Well, I was my duty was down in the shell handling room. The shell handling room. There was only five of us in there, as I remember it. And you had to keep two guns supplied with shells. It was all done hydraulically. You had to pick up a shell and be able to put it in the hoist and close the hoist and get the shell on its way. And depending on how quickly the guns were firing as to how fast you had to work. Sometimes, of course, you didn't, there were long periods where you didn't do anything. You just were there, just ready. But you always had to be there, ready to go. On the upper deck, there was also the 4-inch guns. But they were, the 4-inch guns, had a cartridge type projectile, in other words, just like a bullet. It had a casing, a brass casing, with a shell in the, or the projectile in the end of it, and that was put into the gun just exactly the same as you would a bullet into a rifle. And of course, when it was fired, it would come out and eject. But with the 6-inch guns, the projectile was put into the breech of the gun, and then behind the breech, or behind the shell, there was a cordite bag put in there, which was the propulsion unit. The breech was closed, and then the mouth of the breech, there was a room for a cartridge to go in there. It was only a small cartridge, and a bloke used to carry a great stack of monies on a belt, and he would take one out, put it in, and that would be closed. The whole thing was closed up, and the gun was then ready to fire. It was fired electrically, and the small unit went off, ignited the cordite and the silk bag inside, which when it ignites, of course, it builds up enormous pressure, and out goes the shell. And there goes the projectile, and of course it's a very accurate business when they can. The 6-inch guns used to shoot accurately 18,000 yards. And you work that out to 14-15 mile, and you can plonk them down one after the other, virtually on the same spot on a ship that is could be rolling, doing that sort of thing. It's a very efficient business. But of course, with bigger ships and bigger guns, when they're against you, it's sometimes you're up against it. But that was the reason that we were down the bottom in the shell handling room, pushing these things up and getting them up to the guns.